Welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. Countersign is a podcast where we discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. Discussions are built on slow reading and attentiveness to ideas. You can tune in wherever you get your podcasts or on countersignisapodcast.com. You can receive updates by following me on Blue Sky or LinkedIn. It was truly wonderful to have Professor Patricia J. Williams back on Countersign to discuss her most recent book, The Miracle of the Black Leg, Notes on Race, Human Bodies, and the Spirit of the Law. Professor Williams is the James L. Dorr Professor of Law Emerita at Columbia Law School and is the author of many books, including the highly influential The Alchemy of Race and Rights and Open House. She's currently a University Distinguished Professor of Law and Humanities at Northeastern University in Boston. We recorded our conversation just a few days after that infamous meeting between President Zelensky of the Ukraine and President Trump in the White House. The disrespect and bullying was clear for all to see. But there was also this palpable sense that everything is a transaction or a deal to be done, where the terms of an exchange are not necessarily free or equal. So in this instance, the territory of the Ukraine becomes detachable for the purpose of securing its security and integrity, and it has very little control over the terms that are dictated to it. This is just one example of a contemporary issue that Patricia's wonderful book helps us to think through. The overall question posed and addressed in the book arises out of a world where everything seems to be capable of being owned and therefore severable, exchangeable, and tradable. And if this is the case, is it the law of contract or the Constitution that should adjudicate these sorts of scenarios? The hypercontractarian language and practice that has emerged recalls the way in which persons were owned during the time of slavery, and with the development of new technologies, genes, embryos, and other parts of bodies become capable of being traded. And in that context, will it be laws of contract or constitutional principles that will determine whether these practices ought to continue? The Miracle of the Black Leg is beautifully and accessibly written, and so it's by no means a book only for lawyers. It helps us to confront the ethical and political questions of the current moment. Patricia recalls the fact that, like many African Americans, her foremothers and forefathers were slaves. They were brought into existence as the inventory and commodities of their masters. They themselves wrote about this as soon as it was possible for them to do so. And it is from this treasure trove of material, photographs, writing, that Patricia draws extraordinary wisdom for navigating the current moment. The political gains and critical understanding of race and racialization is now being rolled back and is under attack through an inversion of language, and we discuss the attacks on critical race theory and diversity, equality, and inclusion. How do we hold on to the wisdom to be gained from the past, the practices of mourning and memory that have enabled connecting the past to a future? These are some of the themes that Patricia and I discussed in the context of considering her book. Professor Patricia Williams, welcome back to Countersigned. You were incredibly generous to help me launch this podcast by being my first guest way back in 2020. So it's a great honor to have you back on Countersigned just as I approach the end of my fifth year and the commencement of my fifth series. And we're going to discuss your recent book, The Miracle of the Black Leg, Notes on Race, Human Bodies, and the Spirit of the Law, which was published in 2024. The book has many evocative parables, and we will talk about some of them in our conversation. But the overall narrative charts an opposition between contract and constitutional rights. And you use the discourses of contract and constitutional rights to frame some of the key political and ethical challenges that we face in the United States, but also elsewhere in the world. Would you like to start by telling us a little bit about this notion of the black leg? What is this story of the black leg?
Yes, certainly. Let me just start by saying what a delight it is to be in conversation with you again. And congratulations on your fifth year. This is such a remarkable program, and I listen to it all the time, and I am so grateful to be here again. With regard to the book, I had a student who brought me an image asking me if I knew what it represented. And it is a picture with very Italianate Renaissance composition of a figure lying on a bed or a bier of some kind, hovered over by two figures with halos, who, as it turns out, I discovered much later, are the twin saints Cosmas and Damian. And they were twin doctors, and they supposedly performed miracles. What is remarkable about the picture is that the patient lying on the bed is a white figure, or light-skinned figure, and he has one black leg seemingly attached. You can see the rough edges of the fact that it was actually attached. And then almost obscured at the very bottom of the painting is an entirely black figure with only one leg, who appears to be dead, lying on the ground. And it took me quite a long time to figure out the provenance of this. And apparently the twin saints are revered in the Eastern Orthodox churches, have fallen into some obscurity in the Roman Catholic Church, and therefore are not as familiar, I think, to most Western eyes, certainly not to my own, and to many people who've seen the image. It takes some excavation to figure out what's going on. In the time I didn't know what it represented, I had to speculate, and my mind roamed all over the place, because this painting is clearly, and indeed is from probably the late 1400s, early 1500s, and my acculturated eyes to the contrast of skin colors reads a cultural meaning that may not have been the prevalent way of viewing this. And I suspect that because he's described in some of the literature as a Moor or an Ethiop, it had something to do with overlays of the Crusades or religious significance rather than my dominant impression of racial significance. And so when I looked at it, I immediately thought of Frederick Douglass's description of having to steal his arms, that he stole his body from his master. And he describes literally it in pieces, that he stole this hand, this arm, this leg.
Just for our listeners who may not be aware who Frederick Douglass is,
was
the famed 19th century intellectual who had escaped from slavery. And it was what you're talking about is how he had to steal himself away.
Yes, Frederick Douglass ran away from his master or his owner, I suppose, and moved his status from being that of the object of property, being chattel in our law, fled north. He actually fled to Britain and among other places. And he learned to read and write and wrote a very eloquent series of polemics against slavery, but also an autobiography that is sort of canonical because so few slaves were able to read and write. It was against the law to read and write. And he not only learned, but was masterful in his eloquence. That's why that image is so enduring for me as somebody who grew up in one of the places to which he fled, New England, where the abolition movement was dominant. And so I had all of these associations. I also associated it in my mind with the philosophical meditations of people like Jean-Luc Nancy, who wrote an essay about his heart transplant and what it was like to have this alien piece of another body in his body. And he meditates on the nature of autonomy.
Yes.
And all of this made me think about the construction of autonomy, not just in a Cartesian sense, but as that notion of mind-body duality is picked up in the Anglo-American notion of contract and of the notion of the will and how the law recognizes autonomous expressions of will in very particular ways, but only from certain parties. And that what was so intriguing about it. Contract law in its more troublesome figurations meant that women at a certain point in history could not contract. Not just slaves or freedmen, but also African-Americans couldn't enter into certain kinds of contracts. And so that lack of fullness in the domain of voluntarism and will is something I've been teaching and studying for my career. And I contrast that because now that contractarian narrow sense of individual expression in the form of contract has morphed into something much more comprehensive than simply its exchange of inanimate objects. Contract came into its present form during the Industrial Revolution, and it's become more and more hyper-econometric, almost a risk calculation rather than an expression of the will of the autonomous contractors. And that's in such contrast to the generosity, the comprehensive generosity of Constitution, which is about the constitutiveness of how we live together, how we identify ourselves as one but among many, e pluribus unum, that we legislate with reference and in conversation, in deliberation with one another. And there's no such requirement at the other end of the ethical moral narrower spectrum, which is contract. And there's a role for contract. I just do worry that the architecture of contract has taken over much of what we used to think of constitutional discourse. And that's the essence of neoliberalism, the essence of libertarianism. And I think it's a problem because it's exceeded its bounds and it's swallowing us whole in this moment where industry titans or tech brothers, the new sort of robber barons, are making deals in our name in a way that isn't legislated in the old diplomatic or constitutional bounds of the executive role.
Yeah, we'll come to the tyranny of the deal in a moment. But one of the other extraordinary vignettes and cases that you draw from in order to make this point about the ascendance of a sort of libertarian contract discourse at the expense of a constitutionally protected sense of commonality is the case of John Woods and his amputated and embalmed leg. And what that really conveyed was what you've already sort of connected to, the legacy of slavery and the fungibility of persons and parts of bodies. So
yes.
Fungibility in the sense of the ability to separate parts of the self and alienate those parts of the self, or indeed the entire person in the context of slavery, and that there's a continuity. So the case of John Woods happens in the early 2000s. Perhaps just say a little bit about that case.
Yes, John Wood was flying with his father in a small airplane, which crashed. His father died in the accident, and as a result, his one of his legs was amputated. He was very traumatized by it, and for one reason or another wanted to preserve the leg that was amputated so that he could be buried whole and somehow next to his father, in his world tied up with honoring his father. And he had the leg, he embalmed the leg himself. The hospital gave it back to him. He embalmed it himself. And then he hit hard times. He was evicted from his apartment. He packed up his goods, including the leg. He put the leg in a Weber barbecue grill. He put the grill
ostensibly to protect it, right? You put a steel dome around it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds very kitschy and gothic, but nevertheless, that's what he did. He put it in a storage unit. Then he hit even harder times, and he failed to pay the storage unit fees. And that's when some it was auctioned off. Like you may have seen television programs we have, at least here in the United States, like Storage Wars. It's auctioned off to the highest bidder. And it was auctioned off to a man named Shannon Wisnant. And when he discovered the leg, you know, he freaked out a little bit, but he then determined that it wasn't the product of a murder. When John Wood said, "Thank you for finding it, and I, you know, now I want it back," Wisnant said, "No, no, no. I am a purchaser for value in contract, as the law says."
Yes.
"And furthermore, I have economic uses for this. I'm going to have a house of horrors at Halloween, and I'm going to charge admission to see it." And he had a little poster with adult rates and children's rates coming to see this disembodied, embalmed, poorly embalmed leg. And so it went to court, in which John Wood was alleging, "No, it's my leg," within a referential system of something I think of as constitutional, but which represents a system, a legal system that represents almost the religious value of the leg, the value of a body part that is almost mystical, like a relic. You know, it's like we keep those and revere them, and we and the notion of property is a kind of comprehensive one having to do with the integrity of the body, and that's a dignitarian interest that the Constitution protects, that's apart from the kind of individualism that contract protects. So that's what John Wood asserted in court. And Mr. Wisnant asserted, "No, it's mine," a very different notion of the contrasting senses of my. And it was a purely econometric one. You know, this is of value to me. I can charge, you know, whatever the market will bear for people to come and see it. And this is part of my wealth, my estate, my asset. And it was a thing to him in that sense. The value is fixed by him. It's not inherent in the leg. And that separation of market and inherent value is another of the chief ways that differentiate contract valuation from constitutional valuation.
And I think this case actually connects in an incredible way with some of the concerns of Jean-Luc Nancy's other work as well, which is very much about the crisis of valuing, or what, in the way he put it, the problem of the sense of the world. Like, you know, by sense, he was getting at what could be the source of value and valuing when God is dead in a sort of liberal modern world. From where do we derive value? The case of Wood versus Wisnant is in a sense an instance of, do you simply value the purchaser for value? Does the purchaser for value gain rights that trump the rights of dignity and the dignitarian sense of the person that John Woods was asserting? Now, this amputation and separation of bodies in communities now takes place very much through various kinds of technologies. There's a sort of techno-optimism, and we also see it in the context of new genetic technologies and genomics. So you draw on several of these examples in the book to demonstrate how the logic of contract, and especially the libertarian logic of contract, is driving warping, if I can use that term, social relations.
Yeah, I mean it's gotten a little bit, if I may say so, crazy here, because on the one hand, there's a strong libertarian thread of conversation in which I remember when we were in the heart of the COVID pandemic, people were talking about, we've got to save the economy, while at the same time, willingness to sacrifice essential workers, people working in meatpacking plants, not wanting to close down schools because that would stop the economy. So the priority of what to save really placed money or econometric calculations in tension with public health. And I view, again, public health on one end of the constitutional spectrum, and econometric being sort of the underlying contractarian interests of how we generate capital, which is traditionally the realm of contract. And one still sees that in the present attempt to defund certain aspects of public health. To me, it's shocking, but you know, I think there may be other social factors that this is a confusing moment right now politically. But the other example, of course, is in vitro fertilization. What is the status of a fertilized egg or a blastocyst in a petri dish? And for a long time, it's been considered, you know, a product, and it is the subject of contract between what is in those contracts called the commissioning parent and the hospital or the broker who deals with things like surrogacy or implantation or hospitals that deal with that actually perform the artificial reproductive technology. It's been overlaid and confused, that contract, which I wasn't particularly a great fan of, that you can sort of reduce this to commissioning parent and this thing gets exchanged as though it's, you know, a nut or a bolt, you know, or, you know, a piece of cloth. But now it's been infused with a kind of religious significance. And there are some jurisdictions that are fighting to have the fertilized egg viewed as a full preborn child, even in a freezer where you have frozen embryos. That entity there is considered a full human being. And so there are debates about whether or not that preborn full human being should receive tax credits or tax benefits for the parent, and whether or not miscarriage should result in not just feticide, but homicide against the transporting vessel that we used to think of as mother. So the very sight of the full humanity seems to be moving from the enfoldment, the deep duality or the paradox of a mother with child, to separate, to slice them in two, and they're two separate human beings battling for survival, one against the other, the way these lawsuits are constructed. And it seems to me that contract, being able to contract for certain outcomes, is not helpful at all to settling what is essentially an embodied paradox or even a theological mystery that certainly law isn't going to settle about the status of when life begins. I mean, and our abortion laws were somewhat arbitrary in terms of dividing it in trimesters, but certainly, you know, a concept like viability might be a better way of analyzing this rather than the question of life beginning at the moment of conception, which strikes me as being really quite theological. Again, I think we owe care and immense tenderness in our handling of the reproductive process, but this strikes me as doctrinaire in the extreme, very fundamentalist and punitive. That's the major problem. Is that our laws around reproduction, particularly miscarriage and abortion, have become so punitive that it is no longer the woman's business. It's this fight in the legislative state houses.
Now, I hesitate to move to the issue of the current occupant of the White House, which, of course, is difficult to ignore. But this contractarian logic that is taking shape and being amplified through the notion of the deal that is constantly being discussed. And so last week we had President Zelensky of the Ukraine visiting the White House. And what was being discussed, or what was at stake in a sense, was another kind of dismemberment, the dismemberment of the Ukraine for its rare earth and minerals to be extracted by the US, and that this would be the quid pro quo, not necessarily for Ukrainian security, because of course that was the matter that seemed to offend everyone, the fact that President Zelensky wanted to also discuss the question of the security guarantees for his people. So there is this dismemberment, the sense in which the Ukraine as a territory itself has become fungible in the context of this deal. And then in addition to that, just to wrap in the destruction of all the EDI measures, the sacking of C.K. Brown, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as part of this war on woke. It's a sort of front line of this tension between contract and civil and constitutional rights that have been the great advances, if you like, of the latter part of the 20th century in the U.S. and elsewhere.
Yes. Yeah. And I do worry that so much of that is being undone. Let me address your first point and give me a moment to cry off camera. And thinking about that encounter at the White House, it was just tragic. But it was, hyper contractarian. I mean, contract law, and I don't mean to be too reductive about this, but the elements of contract that I learned in law school were offer, acceptance, and consideration. And consideration was the thing that you exchanged in consideration for somebody doing the incentive for somebody to do something in return. And it's the price. And you do this considering what you will do for me. And the rare earth minerals were not discussed as anything but, you know, you, and it was even, it was not even a, you know, it was bullying. It wasn't contract. It wasn't, you know, it, there was nothing being offered in return because there were no guarantees of security.
Exactly.
So it was, you know, it was unilateral without consideration. And only in exceptional circumstances is that enforceable in the body of contract law. And so that was what was so distressing about this. You do this. And when you commit to doing that, then I might do this thing for you.
Yes.
And so it broke even the structure of contract. But you can consider the world of diplomacy, which one would have hoped we were operating in, which is that there are such things as human rights, as the law of war, as the notion of sacrifice, that we do things for higher ideals, and that there is something that one comes to the aid of one's allies without, I mean, one can negotiate certain kinds of extra or transactional costs, but not to make that the dominant price for intervening in a just war. Because then it's no longer about justice or just. It's about, you know, you haven't paid my price, so I'm going to turn my back on you. That's not about, you know, the way in which, again, we idealize and we memorialize people who sacrificed or did the right thing. That seems to have fallen out of this particular encounter in a major, major way. With regard to your second point,
the EDI measures, because the hyper-libertarian stance and the supposed or apparent discussion about meritocracies, etc., has been a basis or a pseudo basis for an attack on equality, diversity, and inclusion and affirmative action measures, and also for stripping down the federal state.
Well, I mean, this strikes me as having nothing to do with the civil rights movement other than its overturning.
Yeah.
The discourse of merit versus the polarization of merit and diversity, equity, and inclusion implies that all diversity, equity, and inclusion are not meritorious.
Yes.
And it was even more apparent in what our new head of the Department of the Defense said. He said, well, he's the one who made race an issue. And that's because C.Q. Brown had actually talked about how difficult it was for him coming up in the ranks, beginning when segregation was still the law.
Yes, yes.
You know, and the effects of that, and how overcoming that was a milestone in his career. And he wrote that in his biography. And Hegseth said, he is the one who therefore made race an issue. And so it doesn't matter whether or not he was a DEI hire or not. He made race an issue, and that's against the law now.
Right.
And it's just head spinning. What?
Yes, yes, yes.
And then he replaced this 4-star general and several others with a 3-star general. as though a 3-star general equals, who's white, equals a black 4-star general. And the whole question of merit is sort of shockingly undercut.
Yes, absolutely. Nothing to do with merit. And it's hardly, I mean, it hardly, you know, one can't really try to make sense of it in these terms, I think.
I mean, I'm sure it could be explained to me. I don't want to speak against, you know, this is a delicate moment in our history, quite frankly, because I think that it is not just about promotion as usual, merit as usual, whether it's whether we consider DEI or not. This is about a different kind of regime that isn't interested in deliberative negotiations of what or who should be where. It's just don't ask questions.
Yeah.
And one saw that on display in the treatment of Zelensky.
Let's just move on to a little bit more about this presentation of a sense of sovereignty as a certain kind of invincibility. This the libertarian position that we saw in the context of vaccines, for example, the refusal to wear masks, and a matter that you discuss in the book, the extension of First Amendment rights to corporations in cases such as Citizens United versus the Federal Electoral Commission in 2010. Now, this seems to be an extension of the dictum of contract in the one sense, but on the other hand, a sort of distortion of the myth of the American dream. So, and there seems to be also in this context the problem, as you put it, of confusing what we want with what is. And I thought that was a really sort of powerful phrase in a very condensed way. You sort of look around you, whether it's social media or a certain type of consumption, there is a kind of confusion of desire with how things seem to be. So I wondered if you'd say something about that.
Well, I mean, in classical contract, American, Anglo-American contract, the, you know, remedy for breach of contract was the award of the expectation interest, as it was called. And again, contract has morphed, and so now it's much more about risk assessment, but still that's an extension of the notion of expectation. And so when contract came into its present form, you were given the difference between what you were promised and what you actually got. And that measure was the loss of expectation. And that is a kind of future-looking dimension. It's what's given us, you know, that construction of time, that temporal dimension of it, is what's given us the credit industry, for example. You know, that we look forward and you live up to the expectation of the parties. It's not... it doesn't necessarily, it's a narrow remedy, but it doesn't necessarily give you a remedy for what actually happened or for past injury or for the flatness of what is in the present tense or what was in the past tense. It's what should have been. And that speculative dimension is both the glory of contract. It brings into being possibilities that are imaginative, creative, and I think the source of a great deal of wealth. The futures, the market for futures is what it brought into being. On the other hand, it can be a sort of market and hubris when misapplied. And that's what concerns me now. And there's a way in which we seem to be wanting to deploy contract to almost legislate away any and all risks of what happens in the future. And that becomes ultimately expensive in terms of our mobility. When you put things that shouldn't be, that aren't naturally the subject of contract. And by that, I mean, not just things which are, again, things like ball bearings or blue jeans, but you put human necessities and human beings or vivacity into the vice of contract. Social entities that ought to be how we commune. And that's one of the things that worries me when you hear people talking about, for example, Elon Musk, who says we're going to have complete First Amendment on X. He really is talking about his media organ as a private entity, and he's going to let anything happen. But by the same time, he's dealing within whatever his ambiguous role is. He's dealing with an administration that also professes absolute First Amendment, but in the same breath says, but you can't talk about DEI. You can't say this. You can't say that. And so one wonders, you know, what dimension of law one's talking about when you supposedly have utter First Amendment. And my sense of it is that you have utter First Amendment within privatized organs, but you don't have complete First Amendment if the state comes in and says you can't speak or you can't read this or we're going to take these books off the shelves or we're going to deprive public libraries. The public can't speak within a particular privately owned social chat room or the Washington Post, which recently had an intervention by its owner saying, you know, the opinion page shall now be dedicated only to the support and the engagement with private interests. So this, and we're going to avoid political interests, basically. And so the discussion of the health of the polis is giving way to the private sphere, which can be regulated by owners, by ownership, not just contractors, but he who owns. And again, the you know, your BBC, as I recall, has a huge, I mean, it's a public entity or it's responsible to the public. And there's a code of ethics. The Washington Post used to have one of the most detailed codes of ethics that we in the United States had for a broadsheet. I don't know what's happened to it now, but it seems to be altered by its current owners. Many of the broadsheets that are still surviving in the United States no longer have those kinds of codes of ethics. We did away with the neutrality principle in television and radio some years ago. And so media, the conversational space of broad political discourse, is now run by organizations which are no longer even media or news entities. So Fox News, for example, if you look at its corporate structure, it is actually a subsidiary of Fox Entertainment. And so it's overtly an entertainment industry, even as it borrows the name Fox News. It's not bound by the traditional truth ethics of news. It's entertainment. And so you can see that in the way it conducts itself. It's all about capturing eyeballs. It's an attention magnet. So I think that transformation is the product of the privatization of what used to be considered, you know, the public sphere of our political discourse.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And this is not any great insight for me to say this, but I think the loss of a channel of whatever media where there can be some standards of neutrality or an agreed sense that whatever the disagreements one might have about particular issues, that the facts will be checked. We can also contest the facts, but that there are some standards that apply. And of course, this is not the case if you're getting your news from various YouTube feeds or, you know, from within WhatsApp groups, etc. So these various bubbles are being created, and there's this extraordinary fragmentation on the one hand, and at the same time a kind of proliferation of almost a kind of anarchic source of information, which brings me to a different sort of sense of how anarchist scholars and activists might imagine the framing of the book through this tension between contract and constitutional rights, to put it, you know, sort of loosely. It's not the only, it's much more nuanced, but just to put it in those loose terms. And at the same time, I think you sustain in the book a consciousness, a critical consciousness, and a position from which these events and actions or omissions can be judged. So there is the possibility of judgment. And I was wondering how you would locate that, or where you would locate that possibility of a counter position to the observations that you're making.
I appreciate that. In talking about contract and constitution, this is a very limiting framework from one perspective. I don't think you have to be a lawyer or know anything about law to read this book. I think my larger point is a philological one. It is literally how the structure of these two bodies of law drive our vocabulary, as in the contest between John Wood's sense of possession, my leg, as opposed to Shannon Wisnant's sense of my leg. And that to me is interesting in all kinds of other contexts. So for me, it is that, you know, the frame of the book isn't just, you know, offer acceptance consideration as I learned it in my contracts class. It is a larger question of language you cite Jean-Luc Nancy, but in the continental philosophical tradition. And that's where I think, I launched my critique. But right now, I think what we're dealing with in the United States is some very bad faith attempts at propaganda in which meanings are being inverted completely. So again, my concern is about the inversion of language. And one of the things I talk about is the inversion of the meaning of critical race theory. This is, you know, barely a theory. It's not really a theory. I mean, it came about as a conversation among people of my generation and a little younger. That's really where the so-called movement began. And it was at, you know, largely Harvard Law School, but there were so few people of color in those days. There were very, very few of us. There were very few women. My class was 8% women. And we were accused of having a takeover. You know, we were, you know, it was a takeover. I think there were, you know, in the tens, the number of Black students. There were two Hispanics that I recall. And there were almost no Asians at that point, other than those who came to, you know, who were international students who came from elsewhere. And that environment gave rise to conversations in class about the kinds of cases we were studying and the, you know, cases that presented defenses to murder because a husband killed his wife because he thought she was cheating. Honor killings were, you know, in the heat of passion, you know, that was an acceptable defense. And so women spoke up and we started the mm-hmm. Women's Law Journal around mm-hmm. this, around these times. I graduated in the early 70s. And so this, the sense of, not you know, a kind of political movement just to diversify, but it was like, hear our voices. We are here. Mm-hmm, you never really talked to us. Yes. This has never been part of the conversation. And I found it incredibly, it opened up so many realms of law. I mean, it opened up ways of thinking about the law that were precisely that inclusive, more productive. It wasn't just about diversity in this very flattened sense that some in our administration refer to it now. It was, you know, it's a source of knowledge.
Yes.
It's a source of knowledge. I mean, I heard our president yesterday saying, and, you know, we're giving money to Lesotho, and whoever heard of Lesotho? Nobody ever heard of it. You know, well, you know, open yourself up, and it might, you know, there are real human beings there with voices, with needs, with, you know, and you can agree or disagree with those needs, but you can't simply say, you know, who are they, and they don't exist. And that's basically the situation that women and people of color were with regard to the very uniform student body in those days. And it transformed quickly. I mean, the civil rights movement did that. And these are not just laws about merit or policies about merit. I mean, we weren't, remember, until very recently, permitted to stay in the same dorms. So this is about customs and prejudices that have no merit. They are simply, you know, what had already always been done. And so the opening of those doors, you know, I think it's good. Clearly, a lot of people thought, you know, otherwise.
Yeah.
But I do worry that we're going back not just to the 1970s. We're going back to the post-Reconstruction.
Yes, I think that comes out really resoundingly. I think in the book that this seemingly absurd, you know, criticism of critical race theory and complete lack of.
It wasn't just absurd.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a specific attempt to invert the meaning of that conversation.
Yes.
And so you had a think tank with a great deal of money and a very talented provocateur named Christopher Rufo, who owns it, who said, you know, it was my intention to invert the meaning, to rebrand it, to turn it into something that every American hated. Americans never heard of it, but they amplified it.
Yes.
They put it into the, you know, before the legislatures of every state in the union, it became part of the Republican platform. And you would ask them, what does it mean? And they had no idea, but it was a talking point.
Yes.
And so it became the object of resentment and violence and, you know, pushback. And suddenly you have people who actually, as a friend of mine who's on a school board in New Jersey said, you know, she's arguing with parents who say it's evil and my child will have nightmares if you read The Bluest Eye or Toni Morrison. And, you know, she had to point out, but you studied Toni Morrison when you were in high school. So
yes.
Did I?
Yes.
Did I? But that sense of moral panic has taken over.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was just astounded to see the list of banned books. I mean, you know, Toni Morrison's beloved, Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things.
Yes.
I mean, basically anything that...
Art Spiegelman's Mouse about his parents in the concentration camps. I mean, it's astoundingly broad.
Anne Frank's diary.
Anne Frank's diary. It's so, too upsetting.
Yeah. So. But I think the deeper point is that this is. I mean, on the one hand, this is a proxy war that is being fought around critical race theory. But as you made the point earlier, this moment is also taking us back to the post-Reconstruction moment and Jim Crow. And you refer to the Legacy Museum and the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. It's a place I've visited. I went and spent 2 days there. It was one of the most powerful experiences of any kind of monument or memorial I have ever had. It's just extraordinary. And what it documents is the reasons for lynching as a form of anti-Black terror, how it happened, and the many cases that had been driven into a form of, as you put it, sort of family grief rather than a question of public justice. And so this tension between the private and the public, I think, comes out incredibly well. But also the continuities, that there is a continuity from lynching to the prison industrial complex. That there's a continuity from the Jim Crow era to what is now happening in relation to critical race theory. So I think that really brings out the the reflections that you offer in relation to history and memory. And I wanted you to say a little bit more about that.
One of my colleagues actually has done a project of going back and interviewing and finding not just the official lynchings that were so public. I mean, people think of them as night riders and it happened at night. No, I mean, so many of the lynchings in that memorial and in the National Memorial were, you know, public events with hundreds and thousands of people who came to watch it. And my colleague has written a book by hands now known. Her name is Margaret Burnham. It's a wonderful book. But she goes back and goes through coroner's reports and looks at the lesser known killings, which were casual. Somebody walking out of a house and because he's black, he gets shot because he's in a white neighborhood. No reason, just because he's on the sidewalk. Or somebody who goes into a store and touches a can and the owner becomes enraged and follows them out of the store and bludgeons them to death with an axe. Just horrible. But one of the things that she underscores was precisely the privatization of grief. These were killings that were not recorded in newspapers. They were so routine as to, and if people spoke about them, they would be punished because they would point the fingers at people who were not prosecuted. It wasn't just police who were doing this, but, you know, a bus driver who didn't like somebody who was sitting too far in front of the, in the front, toward the front of the bus, you know, they would shoot them on the way out of the bus. And the casual nature of these killings was simply unrecorded. And one way in which that the process of unrecording is not simply that it wasn't spread through the daily newspaper, it's that blacks couldn't talk about it. And sometimes police would come to funerals and make sure that their mourning was within, you know, particular bounds. And you'd look at the coroner's report and it would be, you know, means of death unknown, even when it was very clear that somebody had died by being chopped up by an axe. And this failure to account and the way in which prosecutors, coroners, and the people who handle bodies couldn't speak about it. And families were so grief-stricken that, as with many traumatized people, they lost the ability to put words to it. And in Margaret Burnham's re-encounter, the tracing of where these bodies are, what the families and the children and the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren we're feeling today, says, oh, no wonder my grandmother was so sad all the time. Mm-hmm. Oh, no wonder. You know, there was such a burden. There was such a mystery about it because they were afraid to talk about it. And so that, so the grief that's held within communities is another form of privatization. You know, it can't leak out because it will offend white people. And, you know, if we have a system of anti-literacy that is reemerging now in book banning, you know, I think it's very related to a legacy of not being able to mourn publicly or not being able to scream one's grief for fear that one's killers will hear you. And I don't think that is just a grief held among African Americans. I think it scarred many white people who must have been involved with the families of the people who killed. And that tolerance or adjustment for that level of violence, I think, comes out in some of the brutality one hears being encouraged. The peculiar dynamics of, for example, just Christine Ohm, I feel, I don't know, it feels almost risky to talk about or to hypothesize about the people in our government right now. But, you know, Christine Ohm killed her dog and then was proud of it, thought she put it in a book to show that she had grit or what it takes to make hard decisions. I felt so sorry for her. I felt really sorry for her, you know, and I kept wondering, what did it take to numb someone to what she is actually saying? And the response in the public at large, I think, is testament to the fact that there is something going on in our larger society that looks at certain kinds of violence and says, you know, like in the old Westerns, he needed killing. And without, you know, that to suppress compassion, to do away with sympathy is a good thing. And that the human condition is only as good as your hardest lost nerve. And I think that that's something that is about survival of the fittest, that is also an ethic that is very much seems to be dominating right now. You know, that you know, you'll build up immunity to, you don't need vaccines, you know, we'll just, you know, the best of us will survive. And I think there's also a new eugenics that is emerging, particularly among, you know, people who want to have as many as children as possible. Mm-hmm. The Earth has, I think it's like 100,000 times more human beings, with, you know, of large mammals than the Earth contain. But somehow people feel that they are, because there's a competitive racial race. It isn't mm-hmm. that we're underpopulated. It's yeah. just that they don't like who is populating
yes.
the world. And the fact that the majority of people on the planet are people of color, or would be considered people of color in the United States, is interpreted as a kind of race among hierarchies of human beings. And that's tragic. That just seems tragic, because you can make people stupid. You know, when people, you know, devalue me to my face, I become stupid for a moment. You know, I've become so distracted and enraged and hurt, you know, that you become stupid. And so we can make people stupid by that kind of popular attitude.
Yes, I think that's really powerful, that sort of sense of what happens when you're devalued to your face. I think it's something that I recall you were also talking about in your Wreath lectures now back in 1997, actually, about when yeah. you were trying on shoes and the shop attendant would give you one shoe to try on, the fear yeah. that somehow yeah. you were going to run off if you were given
hobbling all the way.
but also that sort of, and then what to do with that sort of sense of rage that arises when one is devalued to one's face. And I thought the extraordinary wisdom and morality, if I can use that term, that comes through in your discussion of this tension between mourning and memory. I don't know if it's a tension, but certainly a movement of mourning and memory, and the extraordinary resource that you find in your family, in your great grandparents and your grandparents and your parents, that you write about the fact that you have several great grandparents who were born in slavery.
Yes.
And
does every African American, but I have yes. pictures of
yes,
them.
Yes, exactly. That's what is
yes. so remarkable.
The extraordinary archive, right? So it's the sort yeah. of the primal dumpster, as you refer
yes.
to it.
Yeah.
That what you gain, and you know, and I'd love you to say a little bit more about this, that this combination of a grandmother who's also able to tell you, you know, some things have to be let go of, you know, yeah. some things are small things that you can let go of. And yeah. on the other hand, there is this importance of preserving and archiving, because you have the photos and the letters and the writings,
yeah.
the material that you gain from this past.
Yeah, yeah. You know, when I speak about my own writing, many people, you know, were raised as I was with a sense of history, but not personal history, not deep personal history. And among my elders, not so much my mother, but my grandmother and her, because I had them for a long time. They all lived good, long lives. And my grandmother had, you know, five sisters. And I remember at Thanksgiving dinners, they would sit and they would talk, but you would hear them not talk about the generation born into slavery, because they were born literally the inventory of the man who raped them. And that system of breeding, I mean, because it was a breeding system, you increased your wealth by having children by your slaves who would be enslaved, and they could be sold. They could be collateral for loans. I mean, that's what it meant to be the object of that kind of contract. But within many African-American families, not just my own, that's a shameful history, because it's, I think, you know, presented to us as the product of their libidinal desires, that the women were the Jezebels, that the women were the temptresses.
Mm-hmm.
And so it, you know, so in, you know, post-slavery, post-Reconstruction, you know, the uplift movement of becoming hyper-religious and hyper, you know, respectable, what's called respectability politics, is also built upon a deep shame of our raped foremothers. And it was rape. And that was what was so remarkable about having these documents, which, again, my grandmother and my mother were too ashamed to refer to in conversation among us, the children, because it was sexual in nature. But nevertheless, somebody in my family saved all of these pictures and archives and thoughts and, you know, all of them on both sides of my family. The moment they got out of slavery, the moment they had any kind of education, you know, even terrible segregated schools, they learned not just to read, but to write. And I have such a collection of letters. The interior lives, which are so under-recorded, was for me the most astonishing gift, because it's not just my family history. It is, you know, a documentation of the interior lives of slaves that Toni Morrison imagines. But to some degree, I don't have to imagine. It's, you know, this, I hope, you know, is an object of preservation. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen at this very retributive moment where things are not just being taken off bookshelves, they're being taken offline. So we're losing so much history in lots of ways. Mm-hmm. But when you mentioned the memorial, one of the most touching moments about that memorial is that Brian Stevenson and the archivists took jars of soil from each place where somebody had been lynched. And they brought two jars of soil, one for permanent display in the memorial, in the museum, and the other, which they hoped that each town would take back and put on display in their as part of their memorials to this history, to be able to mourn and move past it for the entire population. And what's most moving is that most of those second jars have not been taken back.
Right.
The towns do not want to acknowledge it, do not want to speak it aloud, do not want to bring back that history for acknowledgement and not even, you know, the theater of apology, but mm-hmm. just acknowledgement and mm-hmm. grief. And I think that, you know, without that kind of acknowledgement, we get stuck. That's how trauma works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you lose the ability to express it, you reenact it over and over again. And I do worry that this is a trauma not just on Black families, but on white families who find a sense of safety and high ground in imprisoning and enacting a certain kind of political violence on those marked as, you know, less in the hierarchy.
Mm. Yeah, there's a Derridean archive fever, I think, that I sense you have as you go through these papers and photographs. And it is, as you say, a form of social processing. And I find reading the book as dark and devastating as some of the examples and vignettes are, I came out of it feeling equipped to process painful things, and that there was a real display of surviving that can take place through writing. And obviously, there's the writing that your foremothers and forefathers did, but there's also the writing that you're doing. And there was a set, and I think this is a term that you use or a phrase that you use, that there's a sort of attaching of futures to a past. And if you need to attach a future to a past, that's one way to have a future, in fact. And that's, there's a sort of optimism, I think, in that gesture of thinking about the past as the future anterior, as Derrida put it, right? It is the past of the future.
Exactly.
And if you don't make that connection, then actually you're closing off a future.
So I
found that to be incredibly powerful in the book.
And in fact, it is that Derridean sense of how he hears and sees language that made me think of contract in that temporal, you know, that temporal arrangement that is so much a hallmark of how it, to some extent, doesn't do the same thing as the Derridean future anterior, but it does create an ethical world that cuts off any past. But it's that philological aspect that I find so fascinating in Derrida's writing. And, you know, I think I've been accused of being a Derridean, in which in the American context is the same thing as being a socialist or a communist. But you know, to actually read him is very rich. But he too has become a sort of floating signifier, as Stuart Hall would put it. Like critical race theory, it doesn't mean what it means. And that loss of language, the inversion of meaning, is again a separate and I think quite intentional bad faith aspect of what's going on with our political language right now. In fact, some of the conservative think tanks have put out what's called a cheat sheet for understanding, you know, the lib talk. And so they actually put out a sheet with a list of vocabulary. When they say equity, what they really mean is mob rule. When they say diversity, what they really mean is, you know, the oppression of the tribe and a dictator. And but it goes through a whole list of, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion. It means it means exclusion of white people. You know, it's a very sinister, because if you really absorb that, then everything that comes out of my mouth is going to mean the opposite. It's mm-hmm. going to make mm-hmm. you feel threatened. mm-hmm. And it cuts off the ability to hear. It cuts off the, you know, the invitation of conversation that I try to put out in my writing. And it's literally what, you know, the philosophers have said, you know, words begin to lose their meaning.
Yes.
And so it's that bad faith intervention that worries me most about this moment. And it worries me about the power of technology to take those inversions of meaning and put them on hyperdrive.
Yes.
Again, words have lost their meaning. And that's prime. When you achieve that state, that's prime territory for, you know, a strong man to come and tell you what the word means.
Yes, yes.
To seize the bull and tell you what the word means. You know, you're confused. Let me tell you.
Yes, yes, exactly. And I think that, you know, this sort of lightning speed in which both saying and forgetting takes place. So much yes. is said now through this multiple forms of social and other media that there's a hyper acceleration of yeah. saying and statements, and at the same time, lots of forgetting, because, you know, how could one possibly archive, document, organize yeah. understanding or thoughts in relation to such a large volume of material?
But still, I am astounded by how many people now seem to believe that Zelensky started the war.
Right, right.
You know, it's, yes. I mean, we lived through that moment. You
yes.
know, we
yes,
lived
absolutely.
Through everybody wearing little ribbons, you know,
yes.
yellow and blue ribbons. I mean, and that wasn't ancient history. That's
yes.
almost present. And the dizzying speed with which that narrative has become inverted is very worrisome.
Mm. So, Patricia Williams, I'm so grateful for your time, and you've been wonderful as ever. Can I close by asking you what you're working on right now?
It's I think I am working my way through the rest of my archives, so mm-hmm. I'm not exactly certain what I'm going to find.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am. I actually have a sabbatical coming up, and I am planning to spend my time just reading. And I think, given the political times, I think I'm going to take a break from trying to keep up until the world resolves just a little bit. And I am really going to follow the suggestion, both for political reasons and for not wanting, as I move forward in the future, not wanting to reveal the stories of my near relatives. I think I'm going to start writing some fiction. I'm
right.
just going to have some fun with some fiction.
Right.
I'm going to do some speculative science fiction, Octavia Butler kind of. I'm not a fiction writer. I have no idea whether this will be successful, but I have a sabbatical and I'm going to try to do something different. And, you know, I feel like I have said everything I possibly can in the political realm, and I don't know how to place myself against this new, very incoherent time. And so I'm just going to pull back and, you know, write my dreams. And and they're, you know, they're imaginative, they're speculative, but they're fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
some of them are funny. So I need some fun.
Yeah.
So.
Great. Well, that's both exciting and wise, I think, as in this current moment. So, Patricia Williams, thank you so much for coming back on Countersign. And I look forward to seeing you when you're in London later in the summer.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
You have been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.